So here we are at the end of the poem. You've finished this massive, amazing epic of American democracy. And Whitman leaves us as we would imagine. I depart as air. I shake my white locks at the runaway sun. I effuse my flesh in eddies and drift it in lacy jags. I bequeath myself to the dirt to grow from the grass I love. If you want me again, look for me under your boot soles. You will hardly know who I am or what I mean, but I shall be good health to you nevertheless and filter and fiber your blood. Failing to fetch me at first, keep encouraged. Missing me one place, search another. I stop somewhere, waiting for you.
And we end with that marvelous word, you, which points into the past as well as into the future. Thank you so much for accompanying us on this journey, which, as Whitman would make clear from page one, never ends.
And congratulations on finishing this course and finishing the poem. It's a great accomplishment to read through the poem carefully from beginning to end, and I hope it's something that you'll continue doing for the rest of your lives.
Thank you. Ed, we've come to the end of this journey that began with that signal word, I, and the last word of the poem is going to be you. How did we get there, and where are we next going to go?
Yeah, this is the ultimate test of the equation that Whitman was challenging himself with right at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I equals you. Mm-hmm. Can he get to the point where he convinces us of that equitability between the I and the you? And when he says at the end of the poem, I stop somewhere waiting for you, we've just concluded in those last sections, and particularly in that amazing section 52, an image of a self literally disintegrating, decomposing, diffusing, coming apart. You know, when he says, I depart as air, I shake my white locks at the runaway sun, I effuse my flesh in eddies and drift it in lacy jags, I bequeath myself to the dirt to grow from the grass I love. It's an amazing moment because the I that has been giving us this poem is now right before our eyes, just becoming the landscape, just fading and disintegrating into the landscape.
And we began in the first section with the hawk. We were up in the sky looking down, and now we have come to be underneath your very boot soles.
In this final section, we move, if we're using our eyes to picture what's going on in the section, we move from the sky down to the dirt and the grass beneath our feet. Yeah. And this is the movement here of the poem. It's what I mentioned several sessions ago is descendentalism as opposed to transcendentalism. It's not Whitman taking us up to the skies ultimately, it's Whitman taking us to the ground, to the dirt, to the compost out of which life always is coming and into which life always is going.
And so we are his afterlife. He tells us that he's untranslatable, and yet in one way or another, poets have been translating him anew with every line they write.
Yeah, translators have been translating him, as we've seen on the Whitman web, and I think every poet, at least every poet in the United States, feels both challenged and exhilarated and invited by this final section of Song of Myself. When Whitman says, I stop somewhere waiting for you. Poets have taken him up on that challenge and invitation. And at some point in almost every poet's career, it seems. They have to literally grab Whitman by the lapels mm-hmm. and talk it out with him, talk back to him. Talking back to Walt Whitman is one of the great traditions of American poetry. When you think of the number of poems that American poets have written where they actually talk back, literally talk back to Walt Whitman.
They argue with him, they have a conversation with him.
They talk back across time, and they talk back in terms of challenging and arguing with him as well. And it's a remarkable range. I think of a poet like Langston Hughes, who 100 years after the 1860 Leaves of Grass, which ended with the poem So Long, opens his selected poems, which he modeled in a way on Leaves of Grass, setting it up in clusters like Whitman did. And the opening line of selected poems is from Afro-American Fragment, and the line is so long, so far away. It's like Whitman's So Long at the end of Song of Myself is picked up 100 years later by Langston Hughes as he begins to challenge Whitman about who it is that can speak for the culture of America. And in Langston Hughes's case, it's the claim that I, Langston Hughes, an African American, can speak for America every bit as effectively as Walt Whitman, white man, could speak for America.
Yeah. Or from another angle of vision, poets like A.R. Ammons or Patty Ann Rogers will try to incorporate the findings of science in the same fashion that Whitman was soaking up all of the discoveries of his age and thinking, how can I make these facts sing?
Yes, yes. And we get American Indian poets, Simon Ortiz, Sherman Alexie, who again take on Whitman and examine this odd contradiction, this tension in Whitman between the Whitman who seems to be speaking for the Euro domination of the continent, oblivious to the Native American presence, and yet the Whitman who, from another angle, is absorptive and open and celebrating the diversity of America and recognizing the Native American diversity on the continent. And both of those poets have amazing poems in which they are working with exactly that balance.
Mm-hmm. And a poet like Galway Connell, picking up on Whitman's notion of turning and being a while with animals. And Galway's perhaps most famous poem, The Bear, in fact, he inhabits the body and the soul of the bear. He becomes that other kind of voice that has been so much a part of our poetry.
Yeah, and we need to think too about how Whitman has been picked up not just by English-speaking American poets, but also by poets in many other international traditions. I think particularly of the Spanish tradition where Whitman translates very neatly into Spanish. He sounds like a native speaker in Spanish translations, and he's been picked up by so many poets in the mm-hmm. Spanish American tradition. Poets like Lorca, poets like Borges, Neruda, who have powerful responses to Whitman, and Whitman has been a remarkably powerful influence on them.
And think of the Portuguese poet Fernando de Pessoa, who adopted all these heteronyms, these different persona in which to sing his world, and one of them is clearly a Walt Whitman type figure.
Yes, yes, and we could go literally country by country.
What he gives us, he's going to sound his barbaric yawp over the roofs of the world, and that's an untranslatable word in itself, but in fact, you could say that that barbaric yawp is what every poet owns, and that's what comes from the soul of the poet, that barbaric yawp, and Whitman sounds it off for us, and it's out there over the roofs of the world waiting for us to sound our own. Of course, once you start looking for Whitman in contemporary American poets, you hear him everywhere. I'm thinking of Yusuf Kumanyaka or June Jordan or Campbell McGrath, and of course, most prominently, Allen Ginsberg, who adopts Whitman's persona, in especially in those early poems in Howl. He really takes on Whitman's whole project to bring it into the 20th century.
Yeah, I think of Ginsberg's amazing Supermarket in California poem, which ends with that lovely address to Whitman, "Ah, dear father, gray beard, lonely old courage teacher, what America did you have when Sharon quit poling his ferry and you got out on a smoking bank and stood watching the boat disappear on the black waters of Leyte." And then Ginsberg later would have that amazing poem he wrote while he was in China, "I Love Old Whitman So." Just going back and thinking of everything he owed to Whitman, from the breath line to the openness of the possibility of what poetic subject matter could be.
To the catalog.
To the catalog itself, yes. And you mentioned Yusuf Kumanyaka, who has a wonderful poem called Cosmos, in which he goes back to a now long discredited story about Whitman having an affair with an octoroon woman when he was in New Orleans in the 1840s. And he goes back and resurrects that story because of the possibilities that are opened up by thinking of Whitman in that cross-racial moment. June Jordan, who talks about Whitman as being the one white father that she could look to and trust.
Or think of the Polish poet Czesław Miłosz coming to live in Berkeley in exile and discovering first Robinson Jeffers, who had fallen out of fashion, but who in many ways adopted Whitman's line. And then he finds himself reading Whitman and even translating Whitman into Polish.
We can think too of the beginnings of modernism and Whitman's impact on those poets. The fact that Poetry Magazine, when it began, had a quotation from Whitman on the back cover. We can think of Ezra Pound's arguments with Whitman, and his desire to finally make a pact with Whitman, and move ahead with the modernist poetry that he knew, in some sense, Whitman had started. T.S. Eliot, who continued to distance himself from Whitman his whole career, but who kept moving back to Whitman at key points to even draw from Whitman the opening lines of The Wasteland. "April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land," looking straight back to Whitman's "When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloomed."
Yeah, and it occurs to me that moving into the present, a poet like John Ashbery, so seemingly different from Whitman, and yet you can hear his rhythms in those surging lines of his, and in his desire to capture every part of experience, to name every single thing under the sun.
Yeah, or I think of a poet like Gary Snyder, who has his own reasons grounded in that deep, deep respect for ecological thinking that both draws him to Whitman and distances him from Whitman, so that Snyder would say Whitman's ideas of democracy were great, but they were limited because they didn't give a vote to the trees and to the mountains and to the rivers and to the oceans.
But you could say that Whitman was on his way to giving them a vote, couldn't you? it was quite not quite the suffrage movement, but he understood that at the end of the day, everything had to have a vote. Everything had to have a voice, and that voice is the barbaric yacht.
A child said, "What is the grass?" fetching it to me with full hands. How could I answer the child? I did not know what it is any more than he. I guess it must be the flag of my disposition, out of hopeful green stuff woven. Or I guess it is the handkerchief of the Lord, a scented gift and remembrancer, designedly dropped, bearing the owner's name somewhere in the corners, that we may see and remark and say, whose? Or I guess the grass itself is a child, the produced babe of the vegetation. It seems to me the beautiful, uncut hair of grace.